Hi, my name's Minda, and I'm an addict. And I get to lead a workshop on surrender, which is what the process I'm experiencing right now. I feel extremely nervous. I've never led a workshop. I feel nervous, and I feel honored at the same time. And I'd like to thank my higher power for allowing me to have the courage to walk through this fear and be here and be able to share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. On surrender, and I'd also like to thank the committee. Take a couple deep breaths. I've been to a workshop right before this, and I was listening to what they were sharing, and you know, when the committee first, when I got the phone call, the first thing I thought of was, first thing I was taught by my sponsor was never say no when someone asks you to share your experience. And always think of it as an honor to give back what you've been given. And even though I'm sitting here and I'm shaking in my skin, and I'm thinking, what in the world is my experience on surrender? I'm experiencing it. Before I got into the fellowship, the word surrender, the actual word surrender, was a very negative word. It did not mean anything positive in my life. Surrender meant defeat. It meant, and when I came into the program, just to give you a little bit of history, I came into the program, I was introduced when I was 16 years old, and I got clean when I was 18 years old, and I'm 34 now. So I've been clean now a little over 16 years. And there's... And that is not my doing, just to put it plain. That is grace, that is support from my family and my friends and my sponsor and my higher power that has allowed me to stay clean a day at a time. So when I first got here, my biggest problems was my parents, and it was not the drugs and alcohol that I was using, and it was the cops, and it was that I had to be in school. And there was no acceptance in my life. It was everyone else's problem. And if they would just leave me alone and let me be miserable and be in the pain that I was in, then I'd be fine. And what the real deal was there were people out there that loved me and saw what was going on in my life and did not want to see me continue. And So anyway, surrender was being caught by my parents out on curfew and having to deal with the punishments, and it just was not a good word. It was not something that I had any positive experience with. When I was introduced to the fellowship at the age of 16, I had no desire to have to have surrender in my life again, and I was going to meetings when I was around 17 years old, and the seed was planted, definitely. I did not want to use, but I did not want to feel what I was feeling, and I did not know any other way. And like what I'm feeling now, the emotions that are rushing through my system, and what I'm feeling, that, you know, and just the adrenaline that's running, I have tools today to be able to stand up here and still have those feelings and accept it. I did not have tools back then to deal with it, so what I did was I used. And one of the things that I used for a long time to identify out in this fellowship was everyone has like a drug of choice. I didn't have a drug of choice. I used whatever made me not feel what I was feeling at the moment. And whether it be alcohol, whether it be drugs, just anything. So maybe if I used a little longer, I would have that, but I won't go there. But anyway, so when I was introduced to the fellowship, again, I did not have any desire to have acceptance in my life. I had no desire to live life on life's terms, which is what I learned pretty much surrender is, and that's what I define surrender in today, is basically living life on life's terms. I had no concept of that. Nor did I want a concept of that. So it took a while. It took a lot of sitting around, listening to other people's experience, strength, and hope, and listening to a sponsor, which that also took a while. I was very, very rebellious and very stubborn. So around 17, I was going to meetings. Again, I was not following direction. I had a really difficult time with any type of authority, any type of direction that people gave me. I just wanted the pain to go away. But I didn't understand the correlation between following directions and pain. You know, that would be the easier, softer way if I listened to directions and followed them. So I basically just listened but didn't follow. And sometimes I really didn't even listen. I just kind of nodded my head. But at the age of, It was in November. I had been around the rooms now for about 18 months. And I was so overwhelmed with my feelings and so depressed and did not know how to ask for help and was so unwilling to share what I was feeling that I ended up in the hospital in a locked ward from an overdose. And that's a direct result of my actions. You know, that's a direct result of not being willing, not following direction, and deciding that the easier way for me would be just to check out. And when I woke, that wasn't much fun. It was actually my spiritual awakening. You know, it was the first time that I think the word surrender came into my... At that time, I didn't know that that's what that was. But I realized that I couldn't even... I don't know a better way to say this, but I couldn't even, like, kill myself correctly. You know what I mean? It was like I woke up, and I have tubes down, and I looked like on Sesame Street that's... what is that guy? Snuffleupagus, or whatever his name is. I mean, it was just a horrible... I had all these tubes, and the doctors were saying it was 50-50. I had damaged my liver pretty badly. And anyway, it was the first time in my life that it was up to me. It was no one else's fault. I had put myself in this situation. And what was I going to do about it? And back then, I was a lot more fragile than I am now. And I was pretty fragile. And I'm pretty fragile today, but... not as bad as I was then, and with my emotions, and I just did not know what to do, and all I did know what to do is that this is the one place in my life that I ever felt some sort of belonging, some sort of connection, and it was the connection that was so important to me, and so I came back to meetings, and the first time that I said, hi, my name's Minda, I'm an addict. There was some sort of release inside of me, a physical release that was like, I don't know any other way to express it, but I was home. There was a feeling of belonging and connection, and there was the acceptance, you know, the acceptance that I did not have to carry this burden that I had been carrying for 18 years on my shoulders, that I didn't fit in, that I didn't belong, that I was less than, all the emotions that go along with that, that I didn't have to do this alone, and that I had been doing it alone for many, many years, and I just needed to learn to open my mouth. I needed to learn how to open my mouth and not care about what was coming out, whether it sounded intellectual, whether it sounded stupid, whatever the judgments that that were playing on in my head, in the committee in my head, I needed to stop listening to them and just share what was in my heart. And as soon as I allowed my heart to connect to everyone else's heart is when surrender appeared in my life. And surrender is a very spiritual principle in my life. I practice it, I want to say it on a daily basis, but probably on a more than daily basis. You know, I mean, sometimes, you know, I laughed. I shared in a meeting last night, and I laughed because I was like, are they sure they got the right person to share on surrender? Because last week, which is one of those weeks where I was apologizing to my coworkers almost on a daily basis. It's like I just could not accept what was happening, you know, and it was all of them against Minda, you know. And so anyway, you know, that was my first experience with surrender, was being able to share, in the fellowship and being able to connect to everyone. You know, and from that moment on, I've been able to stay clean a day at a time through the help of, you know, the fellowship, the meetings. I still attend meetings regularly. I still have a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor now since 1991. I use someone who I admire. I admire their fellowship. I admire the way they use the steps. I admire the serenity that she has in her life and that I want to attain. I admire the way she practices and keeps practicing, doesn't give up her vigilance. And you know, I called her a couple days ago and I said, okay, let me tell you what I think surrender is, just to make sure that I don't get up there. And I'm totally off course here. And we laughed a little bit about it, because that's, again, me wanting to, like, give some sort of wisdom that I think I have. And in reality, what I have is my experience, and that's all. And that's enough. And I have to believe that, you know. I have to have faith in that. You know, through the 16 years that I've been clean, I've experienced a lot. I've experienced making choices and be given many opportunities. And in those choices, surrender and acceptance has played a major role. You know, I went away to school. I was given the, just to back up, when I was using, I was dropping out of high school. So the high school wanted to kick me out. And because I just, for some reason, I just couldn't stay in school. I really thought that I was incapable of learning. I felt stupid, and so I couldn't excel, so I was really good at failing, so I just continued to do that. And and I was used to the negative attention, so I fed off of that. And I actually fed off of that for a long time in the fellowship. You know, those behaviors that that we have, you know, even though we're not using the actual narcotics, you know, I still, luckily I have some tools to use on my wonderful character defects. When I went away to school, this was a choice that I made. I made a choice to leave my network of people and move up to upstate New York and go away to college. And, you know, I thought, well, no one's watching, you know, this is an opportunity for me, you know, wow, I get to, you know, I could use whatever I want, you know, I haven't really tried this, and I've heard about this, and those wheels were really turning, and luckily the first thing I did was connect in the fellowship, and accept that I was having those feelings, and that just because I had those feelings did not mean I needed to act on those feelings. And that has been one of the greatest tools that this fellowship has given me, is that just because I have a feeling does not mean that I need to act or do what I'm actually feeling. That doesn't mean that this one or this one?
No.
This one?
No.
This one. That doesn't, oh my gosh, now I can hear myself. So as I was saying about these wonderful feelings that I have, it doesn't mean that I need to act on them. And, you know, that's just a great tool, you know, that I can just sit on the feelings. And sometimes I don't even need to do anything. I just need to feel it. And that is the hardest thing to do when you're not feeling something that feels comfortable. And, you know, you just, the feeling, I mean, I'm feeling it now, so, you know, but anyway, you know, I went away to school, and, you know, here I was having all these thoughts of using, and someone shared in a meeting, just because I was feeling that, that didn't mean I was a bad person or a good person, that was just a feeling I was having, and that I could make a choice of never using again and going through my first few weeks of being clean, because those first few weeks, boy, I was crying a lot. I cried for like years in this situation. Every time people, you know, I share, people are like, oh God, here goes Minda again, you know. And it was just what I had to go through, you know. I'm a very emotional person. I'm very passionate about my feelings, and just a part of me. And there I go, surrender and acceptance, you know. So anyway, so I went away to school, and that was, you know, learning to be geographically away from my original connections in NA and finding other connections. And then in my junior year, I decided to go to Europe and study in Italy. And it's another experience, you know. First of all, I don't know the language. I didn't even think about that. I said, oh, yeah, let's go to Italy. And so I didn't know how to even, like, get groceries, and I had to do all that myself. And then how do you go to meetings? And a little bit about, I'll back up a little bit. My family, when I first came into Narcotics Anonymous, was really ashamed. Very, very ashamed of me. And I had caused a lot of damage emotionally in my family. And just because I came to NA and wanted to get clean did not mean that they were, like, all in joy about it. And that really pissed me off, because I thought, I'm doing a great thing here, guys. Pat me on the back. And they were like, prove it. And that was years. And one of the cool things about my family is, due to Narcotics Anonymous, is that I was able to mend and a lot of the hurt and the pain, and that's, it's an ongoing process. But one of the things that my father did for me when I went away to show me that he supported me no matter what my choices were in life was that he found out where I could go to meetings when I went up to New York, and also he helped me find where I can go to meetings in Italy. And let me tell you, that was like, that was powerful for me. That, you know, for someone who I used to run away a lot, that was like my big thing. I'll show you, I'll run away. Of course, I went like a couple miles to my friend's house, you know, but that was gonna show them. I would come home and all my stuff would be on the porch. And that was not always a good feeling, and it happened more than once. So for my father, who was the one that actually put all my stuff out there, to want to be able to support me and to see, just by example, that this was something that was helping me, whether he understood it, whether he, you know, I guess in his own way, he had some acceptance and surrender in his life, to accept that his daughter could be a drug addict. Excuse me. You know, that was his way of showing me, and that was a powerful moment for me. Anyway, so I went through school, still making choices of staying clean no matter where I was in my life, geographically, emotionally. You know, one of the other ways that I've experienced surrender, I came back from college in 89, somewhere around the 89. No, I graduated in 91. And I found the sponsor that I have today. What happened was I came back, and all my friends that I had gotten clean with around here had moved on. They had gotten married, or they had moved somewhere, or some of them had made other choices. And what was I going to do? I'd always been a follower, so what meetings do I go to? I didn't have a sponsor here, and I moved back to Tacoma Park, Maryland, and where I'm from. And I decided that I needed to make my own connections, go to my own meetings. And first meeting I went to, found my sponsor, and she talked about, how did she word it? She was talking about someone witnessing her program. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know what, I need someone to witness my program. I need someone to walk hand in hand with me through these steps. And we've done that. We do that today. And after that, one of the things that I had to, that I went through that was real difficult for me was, okay, so I have this fancy college degree and I can get a job, right? Well, I couldn't get a job. And the acceptance there and the surrender there was very little. I was angry and I was pissed and I was like, I did the footwork. And why is this happening to me? And oh, poor Minda. And when I get into that type of place, it's a gratitude list is the only thing that comes to mind that I need to do at that very moment. It's just stop whatever I'm doing and start writing. And another powerful tool, you know, people talk about pen to paper, and that is just something I use. And I'll be honest, I only started using it regularly in the last couple of years. But it's one of the things that has worked for me. And at that time, I felt like I deserved a job, that I had paid some dues and I deserved it. And I had to go through a process of living life on life's terms. And at that time in my life, for whatever reason, my college degree in my field didn't mean a lot. And so I had to surrender. And how I surrendered was through talking to my sponsor, going to meetings and sharing about it, and following the process all the way through to the point of just, you know, keep showing up, keep doing the footwork. My sponsor said, just keep doing the footwork, one foot in front of the other, and it will happen. And it did. And I guess it was about 6 years ago. I wanted this great job, so I get this great job with this health insurance, and I decided, well, you know what, I haven't gone to the doctor in years. And when I was younger, I had scoliosis, and I had to wear a back brace. One of my reasons why I use, because, you know, if you had to wear a back brace 23 hours a day, you'd use too, you know, and if it ruined your life the way it ruined my childhood. And the things we come up with to use it. And so I had scoliosis, and I had to wear a back brace 23 hours a day. And I said, you know, it's been, I don't know, 15 years, 10 years since I've had my back x-rayed. I'm just going to go in and get a checkup. Again, that was a choice that I made. And I go into the doctor and I'm expecting him to go, oh, yeah, it's fine, you know. And he says, you need surgery. You've got a five-year window, and you need to have your spine fused. And I just didn't even, you know, I mean, I'm just going in for a checkup. I'm not going in to have surgery. I'm just going in to, like, do the next right thing because, you know, take care of my body. I mean, it wasn't what I was planning. And again, I had to practice that surrender, and I had to practice life on life's terms, and I had to accept what the doctor... Now, I didn't have to. I mean, there's been many times that you don't have to surrender. You can do it a much harder way. And there has been times that that's been my choice. You know, it hasn't always been my choice to surrender and to live life on life's terms. And I have gone through many bumpy roads thinking, well, I'm just going to do it my way just for a little while. You know, just to try it out. And, well, that ended me up in the psych ward, you know, at the age of 18, not wanting to live. And... So anyway, so through this surgeon's suggestion, I called my sponsor, immediately freaked out, crying, not having any clue, never having surgery in my whole life, and doing the next right thing, getting a couple of different opinions, and having the surgery and having to take drugs again. And I hadn't had drugs, but then it had been about, I don't know, 10 years or so, and the fear of being on Percocet, and the fear of being on Demerol, and the fear that, well, maybe it was just a teenage thing, so maybe I'll find out I'm not an addict. And let me tell you about the fear there, at the one place that I had found home, and the one place that I found a connection at. If I found out that it was just a teenage thing, where would I go? You know, I mean, that was intense for me. And needless to say, I found out I was an addict. And but I liked Percocet and I liked Demerol, and and I had a little button. So anyway, I called my sponsor and I said, what do I do? You know, I have to take these meds. And this is before surgery, actually. And how do I plan for this? And I talked to people that had the experience of having to be on medication due to some physical pain. And I walked through it with the help of the fellowship. And it's very odd going into surgery with no pain and coming out feeling like, you know, your whole body's just been blown up. And, you know, I had to learn how to walk again. I had to learn how to accept the body that I have and to accept the scarring, the physical scarring, and to accept that I am who I am and this is what I have to deal with and do the best you can with it. And it's been a process. I'd love to wear those little halter tops, you know, and, you know, I'm just not there. I still have that conscience of the scar, and so I've got some work on acceptance on that, my physical appearance, and you know what, it's good to have work to do. You know, it keeps me coming back. If I didn't have work to do, there's no need for me to be here. So I got through, thank you. Ooh, 5 minutes. So I got through that surgery, and I've been through that. I've also been through with learning to accept and live life on life's terms. You know, last April, yeah, it was a year ago, I had gotten what I considered really my dream job. And I was laid off my dream job. And I didn't understand why. I didn't do anything wrong. And just because 10% of the whole company was getting laid off, you know, I was the last one left in my department. You really should have kept me, because now you're screwed, because without me, you don't know what you're doing. And what's really funny about that is that there's actually someone in the fellowship that worked at the same company, and I saw him today, and he's still working there. And the acceptance is that I didn't have a pull. You know, that anger wasn't there. I've let go of that. And I was happy that he still had a job, you know. That is major growth for me, not to be jealous, envious, angry, pissed off, all that stuff, because that stuff is what I'm used to, you know. It's the other stuff that I'm learning to be, you know, more comfortable with, the other positive feelings in my life. So, I have a job today, and I'm grateful for the job, even though I complain about it. It's so funny, when you don't have a job, you know, you complain about getting a job, you get a job, you complain about having a job. It's like this vicious, you know, cycle, and that for me is living life on life's terms. You know, it's like accepting the humanness that I am, accepting that through all my character defects, that each day that I wake up is a blessed day. And, you know, I'm real grateful to be here today. I appreciate all of you. At first I thought, you know, it's dinner time. There is no one going to be here. I'm like, they don't eat dinner here, you know. I'm like, what is going on? But I am. I'm grateful that that you are here. And I appreciate you listening to my story. And I look forward to hearing Forte's story. So thank you very much.
My name is Forte, and I'm a very, very grateful recovering addict. And I'm glad to be here. I thank the committee for asking me to do this workshop. First thing I thought about was that maybe they had these type of detectives or whatever follow me around for the last 6 months of my life, and they knew that surrender would be a good topic for me, you know. But they know some of the hell I've been going through working on surrendering one day at a time. Most of all, I thank God for grace and mercy. I thank God because I know my story, and I know it's grace that's got me here and that keeps me here. In order for me to talk about my process of surrender, I have to tell you all why I surrender on a daily basis and where I've come from to get to the point that I am today. My story, I was thinking today, a few minutes ago, when she talked about drugs and stuff and being that type of person that would use any type of drugs. I use heroin. I don't like drinking. I don't like nothing else. I like heroin and cocaine, and that's it. You know, and that's all I've done. You know, that's all I'll ever do if I ever use again. But that's what I like, heroin and cocaine. I'm very choosy about my addiction, you know. Heroin and cocaine. But And that's been a process, I tell you. And that's why you'll hear me talk about grace quite a bit, because I know what I've been through to get to where I'm at today. And it's been 11 years since I've had a drink or a drug, and that's just a blessing. I'm from Virginia. I live in Virginia now, but I grew up in D.C. And I want to tell you all how I felt that made me susceptible to having an addiction, to do something to get me outside of myself, even at the early age of 16. 1968, I was 16 years old. I went to a high school called Coolidge in D.C. I went to a junior high school called Backus. And the summer before I went to Coolidge, back then it was the 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, and then you go to the 10th, 11th, 12th. Well, that summer, it's something about when you go from junior high school to high school, if you're still a little kid, if you get ready to go to a high school such as Coolidge, you got to grow up real quick. You can't go in there with that little Bama stuff and acting like a kid, you know, like you do in junior high school. You got to mature real fast, because back then, Coolidge was a fly school. You know, your wardrobe, all daddy buying your clothes and all that stuff, all that had to change, because he's not going to buy you what you want to wear anyway. So what happened was that my father, I'm a junior, and my father's oldest son, I think he saw the dilemma that I was going through, and he bought me a used car. Let me tell you how I felt about myself at that time. I was 5'8". I must have weighed about 180 pounds. You ever see them little fat, little pokey little kids? You would never believe as small as I am now, but back then, I was a fat little pudgy little kid. I had these big tree trunk legs. They were totally straight, no bow legs or anything. They were just big old straight legs. And I had this enormous big head. And back then, you could not, my dad was in the military, stationed at Fort Myer out in Arlington. And everything we got came off that post, the military post. And back then, you went to get your glasses on post. And all we got was those black frame glasses. Those black frame glasses. My lenses were very, very thick. I've worn glasses out about 5 years old. I've been blind all my life, but I've worn glasses out about 5 years old. And my head was big, whereas the meat on my head would cover up the side of the frames and stuff. And so you know how cruel kids can be. I got joned on so bad when I was a kid, and then I couldn't fight on top of it. That made me worse. But it'd be all right if I could fight a little bit, you know. But I couldn't even fight. The best thing I could do was run fast. Thank God I could run. Anyway. But it was very, very difficult for me to grow up. And so my dad bought me the used car to kind of ease the transition to go into high school. And whereas I didn't have a lot of friends at first, I kind of started to get friends and stuff once I got the car. Because back then, it wasn't a common thing to drive like kids do today. You know, you drove your father's big old Chrysler, and he checked the miles, and you didn't go but so far in it and stuff like that. You definitely didn't leave any cigarettes in the ashtray. But, you know, and he bought me this used car, and that's when I got turned on for the first time. It was a nickel bag of reefer and a bumper of beer. We used to call them bumpers of beer. They were quarts of beer, slits, whatever they had out. I think it cost like $1.09. And you can get a fat little nickel of reefer. And if you were good, you got a nice fat one, you get 9 and 10 joints out of it, you know. And as much as I thought that I was okay with me, it was something about that reefer and that beer that really made me feel a part of. It made me feel accepted with the fellas and stuff like that. Now, I didn't know anything about the process of addiction, how one thing leads to another. I wasn't concerned with that at that time. What I was trying to do was feel a part of, feel okay with myself so that I could feel okay with other people. But the process got started way back then. And by the time I got into Coolidge and stuff, the Friday and Saturday nights turned into smoking a joint before I went to class and smoking during break and stuff. I came up with this bright, intelligent decision that I could study better if I smoke a joint of reefer, you know. Even though my grades told me that I was not studying better, but I had this great decision that I could study better. So that was the process for me, and I barely made it out of high school. When I turned 18, I went to my father and told him, I made this profound statement that I'm 18 years old, I'm grown. I want to move away from home, and I ended up moving down this area in D.C. called Sursum Quarters. Yeah, y'all know where that is. Yeah. And that started another process. Now, believe me, when we talk about surrender, I have been trying to surrender to myself, to addiction all my life. I've always looked for a way to stop using. I've always looked for a way that I could just be me, be whole and stuff. But I was either so caught up or figured that I couldn't do it, that I would continue using, thinking that was the only way I could, you know, feel okay with myself. Moving down certain quarters, cocaine, Tabs back then, Mr. Natural, Yellow Sunshine, Blotters and stuff like that. Everybody's tripping and all that, you know. This is an area in D.C., the projects, where I don't know what it was about it. I didn't grow up in the projects, but I always had this thing about the projects. This is where people hung out at, the whores, the prostitutes, and the pimps, and it was lights, and they cussed, and they told lies, and they had these card parties with fried chicken playing deuces and tunk and all that kind. It was the illegal numbers back then. I was fascinated by that shit, you know. I really was. I never had experienced that type of stuff. And I just thought that I fit right in, and I made that my home for 10 years, and in the process of it, my addiction grew from cocaine till I first tried heroin. And the day that I tried heroin, I said to myself, this is the drug that I'm going to do the rest of my life. And I seriously made that in my mind. This is the drug that I'm going to do the rest of my life. Any way possible, I was going to do it for the rest of my life, no matter what it took. And that's what I set out to do. And a real horror story, you know, a real one of Stephen King novels. Just a horror story, you know. All types of stuff just happened. You know, sometimes when I'm in my apartment now, I'll sit on the couch, you know, when you want that quiet time, and I'll sit back and I'll think about some of the stuff that I did to try and feel whole one day at a time, and it scares me. I can't believe it. Sometimes I shudder when I think about all the stuff that I used to do to try to get that stuff in me so that I could go on through the day. It is a hell of a thing to have to go out and search like an animal to try to get something that's supposedly going to make you feel better, and the process never, never ends. It's an ongoing thing. As soon as you get it up in you, you got to start the process all over again. No matter what, no matter how good it is, you got to start it all over again. This is your whole life, day-to-day routine, starting it over again. And the things that go along with it, the things that we do, you all know what I'm talking about. The sadness, the family issues, the hurt, pain that we cause our families, and we don't care because we're on a mission and we have something that we have to do. And something about addiction, it makes you very selfish, that you're self-centered, and you don't care about anybody else, anybody's feelings or whatever. Your main purpose is to do whatever you can to get high one day at a time. Regardless of how bad things would get, I would always tell myself, I'm okay. No matter how bad things would get, I would see somebody that had swollen up hands or abscesses on their neck or whatever, and I would, my right thinking would tell myself, well, I'm not that bad. They got three more abscesses than I do, so I'm not that bad. I can't be that bad, you know. This is the kind of logic that this stuff would have me thinking and stuff, man. Going to jail and becoming homeless and sleeping on the streets and having to humble myself at the age of 25 and 26 years old after making that profound statement to my father, Dad, can I move back home? I'm having a little rough time. You know, I've lost a job again, or I don't have a place. And my father, being the good man that he was, he would take me back in, you know, being his oldest son and stuff, and the addiction would make me steal from him, steal his checkbook and steal his credit cards. And as soon as I thought that he would find out, I would leave out. And it got to the point that my own father had to tell me that the house that I grew up in all my life, I was no longer allowed there. I could not come back there. I'll never forget one incident that that stays with my mind, that it was a Thanksgiving. And you know, it's a sad thing when you live right in a city where your family is, and Thanksgiving and Christmas when the families gather together and stuff like that, and you're not allowed to go home. And one Thanksgiving I went there thinking after a certain amount of time that their hearts might have softened a little bit, but I had done some damage. And I went to the house, my family's house, and I was met at the door with a paper plate and said, "I'm sorry, you can't come in." Now, I can tell y'all that I was good and high that day or whatever, but I felt that pain and stuff. I felt the humiliation that I felt that day, but that didn't stop me. That didn't stop me. I kept right on the mission that I was on. 1986, I'm doing real, real bad. In my early 30s, time is going by. You know, time is steadily going. I don't even realize how fast time is going by. And I overdose, end up in Howard University Hospital. And I never told them to take the HIV test. You had to sign a consent form to take the test. The only conclusion that I have today that they took the test was because I had been living on the streets, which means I wasn't taking a bath on a regular basis. I was so dirty and filthy, I believe that they took the test as a matter of precaution to protect their own self, which I understand today. And I remember them telling me after a week and a half that I came back HIV positive. It wasn't a shock. Back then, the all joints, if you didn't have a pair of works, there was always a mayonnaise jar with six or seven syringes. And if you're anything like me, when you get sick, you're going to get that stuff up in you. Uh-huh. So you'll get one of those out of that jar, uh-huh, and you'll call yourself cleaning it with some dirty water that's in there, and you'll use it. And when they told me, I said, okay, what do you want me to do? And they explained to me that I need to come back to the hospital. You know, this feel about trying to take care of myself. This is a fatal disease. Get off the drugs. Back then I was smoking cigarettes. Come back for follow-ups. I think they only had one medication back then, was AZT. The same day I got out of the hospital, my addiction, I went right back to using. I shared needles with other people. I'm not an honest addict. I don't go into an all joint and announce that I'm HIV positive. You don't want to use my needles. I shared needles with other people and didn't tell them I was HIV positive. At this time, I am so disgusted with my life and myself that I've made this decision in my mind that you might as well do one or two things, because there's no need for you to try to start again. It's too late. You know, you're in your 30s now. You're getting older. Either overdose or let the HIV kill you. There's no use in trying to start over. And that's what I set out to do. 5 years later, March 31st, 1991, I was in a motel out on Richmond Highway in Alexandria, where I live at now. What I would do, I was selling drugs in this area in D.C., and once a week or twice a week, I would get a motel on this little strip over in Alexandria. I would get a hotel just to go in there and lay down and get off my feet for one night, take a bath, you know, and just rest. And this particular night, I had been sick for a couple of months. I mean, I couldn't weigh no more than 80 pounds. I was sweating. I had these bad night sweats. I was throwing up. I thought I had a bad case of the flu, but once again, heroin has morphine in it. And my conclusion is that if I shoot enough dope, sooner or later, whatever it is, the morphine will take care of it. It'll go away. You know, this is what I'm thinking. But this particular night, again, I talk about grace. I don't know what it was, but I got scared, and I walked out the hotel, and I went to the phone booth, and I called 911. And they came and took me to this hospital. And when I woke up again, it was April 28th. And the doctors come in the room with this real serious ass look on their face with these gloves and these masks, and I say, oh shit, they got some news to tell me. First of all, I'm in this plastic tent, this oxygen tent, and I've got these breathing apparatus on my face and these tubes and stuff. And I knew I was really sick, but they come and tell me, and they say, Mr. Forte, the HIV has progressed to AIDS. You're also hepatitis C positive. Do you have someone, a next of kin, that you can call? Now check this out. The first thing that came to my mind when any little amount of clarity came was that you're 39 years old, you're homeless, you have AIDS, they're telling you there's a possibility that you might die, and all you did when you were 16 years old was smoke a joint of reefer and drink some beer. How in the fuck did you end up here 20 years later? What happened? 20 years later, how can you stop yourself? Why didn't you get any help? At that point, I can be real honest with you all. I was just about 40 years old, and the only remedy that I could come up for was for God to go ahead and take me away. I couldn't see. I'm a felon. I'm a junkie. I have AIDS. Who was going to hire me? How was I going to start? What was I going to do? You know, but you'll always hear me talk about grace and mercy and what God is capable of. He will reach down real low, and he'll pick up the ones that everybody has counted out. And he'll put him on the right path. I surrendered March the 31st, 1991. And it's been a hell of a journey. Surrendering one day at a time to life and life's turns, my disappointments with myself, my family, being powerless, my health issues, surrendering and trying to keep my faith and believing in the God that has brought me this far, and telling myself in the midst of the storm. See, we can always talk about how good God is, but get inside something and see if you'll still praise God for what he's done for you, because I know that. When you're in the midst of that storm, boy, your faith weathers sometimes. I tell you, it gets shaky. I know it because I've been going through it here lately. My liver's messing up now, and which means that I may have to start that interferon, and I'm scared. I can be honest about that. I'm scared because I don't know what it's going to bring, you know, and life has been good the last 11 years, and I'm not ready to give it up. But at the same time, if I had to, I would say to myself, well, these have been the best years of my life. Out of all my 40-something years, these have been the best years, you know. I surrendered to a lot of things on a day-to-day basis, medications, people, wanting a relationship. How do you ask another human being to be involved? See, I don't just have baggage. I got those suitcases that these do on steamers. You know that shit you take on the ocean liner with you. You know, somebody really got to be open and ready for a relationship. You know. So you deal and you surrender to the fact that you're alone but not lonely. You know. The doctors tell you that your liver's acting up and starting different medications and wanting to be okay with me and people. I got a part-time job as emergency witness shelter in Alexandria. And I see people in the midst of addictions. And so you try to convey your story sometimes to them, hoping. But then there are people just like me. They had to get it when they get it. And I can't do anything about this. So I had to surrender to the fact that they want to be homeless and they're all right with being homeless, you know, at the time or whatever. My friends, my family, trying to convey to my family the reason that I feel about certain things the way that I do as far as my addiction is concerned and why I go to meetings on a day-to-day basis and why you all are so important to me. Why if we're having dinner, I have to get up and leave because I'm supposed to be at a meeting, and I have to go there. It hasn't been an easy journey. This year has been very, very difficult. But there's something about, you know, surrendering to going on in spite of and holding on regardless of what happens and not wanting to use anymore. And a lot of times it's not so much about not using. It's about just being okay with life and being okay with yourself. And August, God willing, and I know he is, I'll turn 50 years old. And I can say that now, but fuck. You know, I heard her say that she got clean when she was 18. I started saying, whatever. Why could I get it at that age? You know, but... But I don't know, it's a day-to-day process for me. I've done some things in recovery. Relationships. I try to stay away from them nowadays. I try not to even talk about it, even when it comes to sex and stuff, because I'm not one to surrender sometimes so easily. If I do, I leave claw marks, you know. So I have to learn to kind of, you know, do it on a day-to-day basis. But my process of surrender, my sponsor tells me that when you get tired of doing certain shit, you'll stop. When the pain get great enough, you'll stop. And I've learned that since I've been here and stuff. It's taken time for me to learn, but I've learned it. I thank the committee for asking me to do this workshop. I love being able to tell people, and I don't push religion or spirit on anybody, but I love being able to tell people what God has done for me, you know, because he's done a whole lot. And I think if you come to this program, there was a tape I heard in North Carolina, and the speaker said that I thank God for bringing me to NA, and I thank NA for bringing me back to God. Yeah. And I believe in it. Thanks for letting me share.